welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from radio's past. I'm your host, Mark Levanier, and this hour, True History, featuring the first hour of about a two-hour profile of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his four terms in office, produced about a year after his death on April 12, 1945. This NBC show called A Rendezvous with Destiny, heard on March 27, 1946.
There is a mysterious cycle in human events. To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny.
Rendezvous with Destiny, a recording of historic moments preceding and during the Second World War, as reflected in the speeches of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, broadcast over the nationwide facilities of the National Broadcasting Company. For the first time, radio broadcasting has made possible a documentary record of a memorable era in the history of the United States, in the voice and words of one of its chief protagonists.
The story of the first term.
The theory of the responsibility of government for human welfare.
Hope for the forgotten man.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt became president of the United States at a crucial moment in its history, in the midst of one of the greatest crises in the history of mankind. He came to leadership in a world rocked to its foundations by social and economic upheavals, following in the wake of the greatest war it had yet seen, the First World War. Here in America, the meaning of that crisis was but partly understood. We called it the Depression. We thought it was just another downward swing in the familiar cycles of the industrial age. Some of us explained it as a mere business slump, a financial panic after a speculative boom. But never had such a slump, such a panic, such a catastrophe overtaken our people. Factories were two-thirds idle. Business was stagnating. Prices of farm products and all commodities had collapsed. Billions of dollars in paper values had disappeared. A wave of bank failures swept the country. 16 million people were without jobs. There were bread lines in the cities, homeless wanderers on the road. Agriculture had been declining for 10 years. Now farm families by the thousands were driven from their mortgaged homes. The land itself had been ravaged by natural forces, droughts, dust storms, and floods. Few men had ever faced so seemingly hopeless a task as Franklin Roosevelt, as he rode to his inauguration on that gray March day of 1933. Thousands stood expectantly as Chief Justice Hughes administered the oath on the Capitol steps.
I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God.
Millions listened at their radios throughout the country and all over the world as the new president began his first inaugural address.
President Hoover, Mr. Chief Justice, my friends, this is a day of national consecration, and I am certain that on this day my fellow Americans expect that on my induction into the presidency, I will address them with a candor and a decision which the present situation of our people impels. This is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly and boldly. Nor need we shrink from honestly facing conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure as it has endured. We will thrive and we will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Our greatest primary task is to put
People to work. This is no unsolvable problem if we face it wisely and courageously. It can be accomplished in part by direct recruiting by the government itself, treating the task as we would treat the emergency of a war, but at the same time, through this employment, accomplishing greatly needed projects to stimulate and reorganize the use of our great natural resources. Hand in hand with that, we must frankly recognize the overbalance of population in our industrial centers, and by engaging on a national scale in a redistribution, endeavor to provide a better use of the land for those best fitted for the land. I am prepared, under my constitutional duty, to recommend the measures that a stricken nation in the midst of a stricken world may require. These measures, or such other measures, as the Congress may build out of its experience and wisdom, I shall seek within my constitutional authority to bring to speedy adoption. But in the event that the Congress shall fail to take one of these two courses, in the event that the national emergency is still critical, I shall not evade the clear course of duty that will then confront me. I shall ask the Congress for the one remaining instrument to meet the crisis: broad executive power to wage a war against the emergency as great as the power that would be given to me if we were in fact invaded by a foreign foe. For the trust reposed in me, I will return the courage and the devotion that befits the time. I can do no less.
And so opened the thundering era known to history as the New Deal. For 4 days, banks were shut all over the United States. Congress, in special session, passed the first Emergency Act. Under dynamic pressure of the White House, a flood of legislation poured from the Capitol in the course of a hectic 100 days. Emergency Banking Act, Emergency Relief, Conservation and Crop Control, Truth and Securities Act, Farm Credits, Homeowners Loans, Deposit Insurance, bills creating federal corporations, administrations, and agencies, FERA, CCC, AAA, TVA, NRA, bills appropriating vast sums to finance recovery and relief. A wave of revolutionary fervor swept the land as NRA Blue Eagle emblems appeared on letterheads, placards, and flags to attest loyalty of business to the new industrial code. Speeches and exhortations and slogans kept enthusiasm alive. Then followed the long-term program for relief, recovery, and reform. Emergency relief put millions of men to work through PWA and WPA. Public works, bridges, highways, hospitals, schoolhouses, post offices, armories, swimming pools, and camping grounds were built as billions of dollars poured from the treasury. Vast numbers of trees were planted in reforestation belts, check dams constructed against floods. Cultural projects flourished with federal aid. Theater companies, orchestras, lecture courses, workshops. The USA became a vast beehive of creative activity. There were voices of approval and voices of dissent. People were busy, business activity climbed, confidence returned. By 1936, it looked like prosperity once more. Yet in the spring of 1936, no less than 6 million American families were still receiving aid through relief agencies and from publicly financed work. Two basic laws, passed in the third year of the Roosevelt administration, marked the character of the new times: the National Labor Relations Act, establishing the right of collective bargaining, and the Social Security Act, which, in the words of the president, confirmed the continued responsibility of government for human welfare. The majority of Americans approved and showed it at the polls. In November 1936, Roosevelt was swept back into office by an all-time majority, carrying every state but two. The New Deal had been called for a second term.
of the second term. America facing a hostile world. The forces of aggression confront democracy.
On January 20th, 1937, a deliriously happy crowd stood in the driving rain outside the Capitol and cheered the president as he began his second inaugural address.
My fellow countrymen, when 4 years ago we met to inaugurate a president, the Republic, single-minded in anxiety, stood in spirit here. We dedicated ourselves to the fulfillment of a vision, to speed the time when there would be for all the people that security and peace, essentials in the pursuit of happiness. We of the Republic pledged ourselves to drive from the temple of our ancient faith those who had profaned it, to end by action, tireless and unafraid, the stagnation and despair of that day. We did those first things first. But our present gains were won under the pressure of more than ordinary circumstance. Advance became imperative under the goad of fear and suffering. The very times were on the side of progress. To hold to progress today is more difficult. So let us ask again, have we reached the goal of our vision of that fourth day of March, 1933? Have we found our happy valley? I see a great nation upon a great continent, blessed with a great wealth of national resources. Its 130 million people are at peace among themselves. They are making their country a good neighbor among the nations. I see a United States which can demonstrate that under democratic methods of government, national wealth can be translated into a spreading volume of human comfort hitherto unknown. And the lowest standard of living can be raised far above the level of mere subsistence. But here is the challenge to our democracy. In this nation, I see tens of millions of its citizens, a substantial part of its whole population, who at this very moment are denied the greater part of what the very lowest standards of today call the necessities of life. I see one-third of a nation ill housed, ill clad, ill nourished. The test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much. It is whether we provide enough for those who have too little. If I know aught of the spirit and purpose of our nation, we will not listen to comfort, opportunism, and timidity. We will carry on.
The people still applauded, but opposition developed in Congress, in the court, and in the circles of big and little business as the president proposed far-reaching measures to complete the New Deal reform. Partisanship rose to fever heat with the president's attack on the Supreme Court and his proposal for judicial reform. A further $1.5 billion was required for relief. In midsummer 1937, the country's economy sagged and sank into another decline. By this time, the economic disease was seen to be worldwide. Its roots lay even deeper than we thought. They reached far beyond our national frontier. Country after country sought salvation in self-sufficiency and isolation in a sullen and increasingly hostile world.
while Europe rearmed, America had sought safety against embroilment in foreign wars by means of neutrality acts. But the voices of the dictators became more strident day by day. Hitler marched into the Rhineland. Mussolini conquered Ethiopia. Civil war raged in Spain, and the totalitarians used it as a practice ground. The League of Nations had collapsed as an instrument of peace. The Berlin-Rome Axis and the anti-Comintern alliance between Germany, Italy, and Japan began their plotting against the democratic world. In August 1937, Japanese troops entered Beijing. In America, the threat to world peace was beginning to be understood. But most Americans were still unwilling to face the facts and weigh the consequences of our passive neutrality. As the president toured the western states, he was increasingly troubled. Toward the end of the tour, at Chicago, he decided to speak his mind. His warning startled the country and reverberated through the world.
The political situation in the world, which of late has been growing progressively worse, is such as to cause grave concern and anxiety to all the peoples and nations who wish to live in peace and amity with their neighbors. Some 15 years ago, the hopes of mankind for a continuing era of international peace were raised to great heights when more than 60 nations solemnly pledged themselves not to resort to arms in furtherance of their national aims and policies. The high aspirations expressed in the Briand-Kellogg Pact and the hopes for peace thus raised have of late given way to a haunting fear of calamity. The present reign of terror and international lawlessness began a few years ago.
It seems to be unfortunately true that the epidemic of world lawlessness is spreading. And mark this well. When an epidemic of physical disease starts to spread, the community approves and joins in a quarantine of the patient in order to protect the health of the community against the spread of the disease. War is a contagion, whether it be declared or undeclared. It can engulf states and peoples remote from the original scene of hostilities. Yes, we are determined to keep out of war. Yet we cannot insure ourselves against the disastrous effects of war and the dangers of involvement. We are adopting such measures as will minimize our risk of involvement, but we cannot have complete protection in a world of disorder in which confidence and security have broken down. If civilization is to survive, the principles of the Prince of Peace must be restored. Shattered trust between nations must be revived. Most important of all, the will for peace on the part of peace-loving nations must express itself to the end that nations that may be tempted to violate their agreements and the rights of others will desist from such a cause. There must be positive endeavors to preserve peace. America hates war. America America hopes for peace. Therefore, America actively engages in the search for peace.
...1938 opened in an atmosphere of uncertainty and fear. The recession had steadily deepened. In a special message, the president called for a new spending and lending program, for priming the pump and for consolidating the New Deal. The Supreme Court confirmed much of the required legislation. But abroad, war clouds thickened.
Japanese planes sank the American gunboat Panay. Congress voted to build the biggest navy in the world. Now all Europe heard the tramp of Nazi stormtroops. In March, Hitler seized Austria. Fascist mobs cheered Hitler and Mussolini through the streets of Rome. The Fuhrer flung his threats at Czechoslovakia. Europe hurtled to the brink of war. Then the Munich Pact, the sacrifice of a little nation to its neighbor's greed. European democracies took refuge in ignominious appeasement. "I bring you peace," cried Chamberlain back from Munich. "Peace in our time." But there was no peace. There was violation of treaties, betrayal, and feverish rearmament. Against that somber background, the president reported on the state of the nation to Congress January 4th, 1939.
As this 76th Congress opens, there is need for further warning. A war which threatened to envelop the world in flames has been averted. But it has become increasingly clear that world peace is not assured. All about us rage undeclared wars, military and economic. All about us grow more deadly armaments, military and economic. All about us are threats of new aggressions, military and economic. Storms from abroad directly challenge three institutions indispensable to Americans now as always. The first is religion. Religion is the source of the other two, democracy and international good faith. There comes a time in the affairs of men when they must prepare to defend not their homes alone, but the tenets of faith and humanity on which their churches, their governments, and their very foundations are set. The defense of religion, of democracy, and of good faith among nations is all the same fight. To save one, we must now make up our minds to save all. In meeting the troubles of the world, we must meet them as one people, with a unity born of the fact that for generations, those who have come to our shores, representing many kindreds and tongues, have been welded by common opportunity into a united patriotism. If another form of government can present a united front in its attack on a democracy, the attack must and will be met by a united democracy. Such a democracy can and must exist in the United States. Once I prophesied that this generation of Americans had a rendezvous with destiny. That prophecy comes true. To us, much is given. More is expected. This generation will nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope of earth. The way is plain, peaceful, generous, just. A way which, if followed, the world will forever applaud, and God must forever bless.
Destiny marched onward with sinister stride. Munich had made war inevitable. On March 15th, defying the Munich guarantees, Hitler marched into Prague. 2 weeks later, Mussolini occupied Albania. Frantically, Britain and France tried to save what remained, gave more guarantees to Poland, Romania, Turkey, Greece. Hitler threatened Poland. President Roosevelt sent an 11th-hour appeal for peace. All summer, there were threats and counter-threats, while Britain and France failed in a half-hearted attempt to bring Soviet Russia into line. Then, the diplomatic bombshell of the century, the Nazi-Soviet pact. Before dawn of September 1st, Nazi tanks rumbled into Poland. On September 3rd, France and Britain were at war with the Nazi Reich.
That night, in one of his fireside chats, the president addressed the nation in solemn, fateful words.
My countrymen and my friends, tonight my single duty is to speak to the whole of America. Until 4:30 o'clock this morning, I had hoped against hope that some miracle would prevent a devastating war in Europe and bring to an end the invasion of Poland by Germany. For 4 long years, a succession of actual wars and constant crises have shaken the entire world and have threatened in each case to bring on the gigantic conflict, which is today, unhappily, a fact. I myself cannot and do not prophesy the course of events abroad. And the reason is that because I have of necessity such a complete picture of what is going on in every part of the world, that I do not dare to do so. And the other reason is that I think it is honest for me to be honest with the people of the United States. I cannot prophesy the immediate economic effect of this new war on our nation. But I do say that no American has the moral right to profiteer at the expense either of his fellow citizens or of the men, the women, and the children who are living and dying in the midst of war in Europe. Some things we do know. Most of us in the United States believe in spiritual values. Most of us, regardless of what church we belong to, believe in the spirit of the New Testament, a great teaching which opposes itself to the use of force, of armed force, of marching armies and falling bombs. The overwhelming masses of our people seek peace, peace at home, and the kind of peace in other lands which will not jeopardize our peace at home. We have certain ideas and certain ideals of national safety, and we must act to preserve that safety today and to preserve the safety of our children in future years. This nation will remain a neutral nation. But I cannot ask that every American remain neutral in thought as well. Even a neutral has a right to take account of facts. Even a neutral cannot be asked to close his mind or close his conscience. I have said not once, but many times, that I have seen war and that I hate war. I say that again and again. I hope the United States will keep out of this war. I believe that it will. And I give you assurance and reassurance that every effort of your government will be directed toward that end. As long as it remains within my power to prevent, there will be no blackout of peace in the United States.
The winter of 1939-1940 was a winter of gloom. Sadness, anger, and perplexity gripped the people as the Nazi blitzkrieg thundered through Poland, as the Russians invaded Finland, and the so-called phony war dragged on in the West. Then, through spring and summer, with fear and fury in their hearts, they watched the grim tragedy in Norway, the Low Countries, and France. The ordeal of Dunkirk, the fall of France, the Battle of Britain strained emotions to the breaking point. Fear that Britain might be invaded was a constant nightmare as summer faded into autumn. Technically, the United States was still neutral, but actually, it was ever more conscious that the ultimate threat was a threat to us. In May, the president called for the production of 50,000 planes within the year. In a personal plea to Congress, he asked $1 billion for immediate measures of defense. In June, he pledged the material resources of this nation to the opponents of force. In July, Congress appropriated funds for a two-ocean navy, adding 200 vessels to our fleet. In September, 50 United States destroyers were turned over to Britain in return for 99-year leases of British bases in this hemisphere. And Congress passed the Selective Service Act to mobilize the nation's manpower for defense. The World War overshadowed all domestic issues, but party lines were forming for the presidential campaign. Wildly applauded for his foreign policy, the president met with bitter hostility on domestic issues. Conservatives in Congress and the business world resented the ever-increasing power of the executive, the growth of government agencies, the piling up of expenditures for administration and relief. But withal, there was the mounting demand by Democrats that the president be drafted. Opposing the traditional feeling against the third term stood the president's undiminished popularity with the majority of plain citizens and the realization that the nation was in midstream. The president gave no hint of his intentions until the Democratic convention in July, 3 weeks after Wendell Willkie had been nominated as the Republican candidate.
At the Democratic National Convention in the Chicago Stadium, Franklin D. Roosevelt was nominated by his party as the first third-term candidate in the history of the United States. It was late at night, and the delegates were soon to adjourn. But they and their fellow citizens throughout the nation listened as the president accepted the mandate of his party in a radio speech from the White House.
Members of the convention, my friends, it is very late tonight, but I have felt that you would rather that I speak to you now than wait until tomorrow. It is with a very full heart that I speak tonight. I must confess that I do so with mixed feelings, because I find myself, as almost everyone does sooner or later in his lifetime, in a conflict between deep personal desire for retirement on the one hand and that quiet, invisible thing called conscience on the other. Lying awake as I have on many nights, I have asked myself whether I have the right, as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, to call on men and women to serve their country or to train themselves to serve and at the same time decline to serve my country in my personal capacity if I am called upon to do so by the people of my country. In times like these, in times of great tension, of great crisis, the compass of the world narrows to a single fact. The fact which dominates our world is the fact of armed aggression, the fact of successful armed aggression, aimed at the form of government, the kind of society that we in the United States have chosen and established for ourselves. It is a fact which no one any longer doubts, which no one is any longer able to ignore. It is not an ordinary war. It is a revolution
imposed by force of arms which threatens all men everywhere. It is a revolution which proposes not to set men free, but to reduce them to slavery. To reduce them to slavery in the interest of a dictatorship which has already shown the nature and the extent of the advantage which it hopes to obtain. That is the fact which dominates our world and which dominates the lives of all of us, each and every one of us. In the face of the danger which confronts our time, no individual retains or can hope to retain the right of personal choice which free men enjoy in times of peace. He has a first obligation to serve in the defense of our institutions of freedom, a first obligation to serve his country in whatever capacity his country finds him useful. Like most men of my age, I had made plans for myself. Plans for a private life of my own choice and for my own satisfaction. A life of that kind to begin in January 1941. These plans, like so many other plans, had been made in a world which now seems as distant as another planet. Today, all private plans, all private lives, have been in a sense repealed by an overriding public danger. In the face of that public danger, all those who can be of service to the Republic have no choice but to offer themselves for service in those capacities for which they may be fitted. Those, my friends, are the reasons why I have had to admit to myself, and now to state to you, that my conscience will not let me turn my back upon a call to service. The right to make that call rests with the people through the American method of a free election. Only the people themselves can draft a president. If such a draft should be made upon me, I say to you in the utmost simplicity, I will, with God's help, continue to serve with the best of my ability and with the fullness of my strength.
The election campaign of 1940 showed that America was united as never before. But in agony, we watched the tragic struggle across the seas. Britain fighting alone for survival. Italy, Germany's Axis partners, striking at Britain's lifelines in the Near East. Japan pushing deeper into China, now making common cause with the Axis through the tripartite pact aimed at any outside power which might aid the democracies. Aimed, in fact, at the United States. For American security depended on Britain's survival. And Britain's survival depended on us, on our productive power to keep her armed. The president summed up the situation on the eve of the fateful year of 1941.
We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war. As President of the United States, I call for that national effort. I call for it in the name of this nation which we love and honor, and which we are privileged and proud to serve. I call upon our people with absolute confidence that our common cause will greatly,
succeed.
The war was coming closer to America. The lines were clearly drawn. On one side, the fascist New Order in Europe and Asia. On the other, the forces for freedom throughout the world. Britain and Greece were fighting for their lives, their supplies diminished under the hammer blows of Axis air power. The burden fell more heavily on us. Our production was not yet geared for war. Only a small fraction of the materials ordered by Britain had been shipped. Britain's buying power under the rule of cash and carry was vanishing fast. On January 6, 1941, the president offered his solution of the problem and his concept of the nation's aim as he delivered his annual message to the Congress.
President, Mr. Speaker, members of the 77th Congress, I address you, the members of this new Congress, at a moment unprecedented in the history of the Union. I use the word unprecedented because at no previous time has American security been as seriously threatened from without as it is today? New circumstances are constantly begetting new needs for our safety. I shall ask this Congress for a greatly increased new appropriation and authorization to carry on what we have begun. I also ask this Congress for authority and for funds sufficient to manufacture additional munitions and war supplies of many kinds to be turned over to those nations which are now in actual war with aggressor nations. Our most useful and immediate role is to act as an arsenal for them as well as for ourselves. They do not need manpower, but they do need billions of dollars worth of the weapons of defense. The time is near when they will not be able to pay for them all in ready cash. We cannot and we will not tell them that they must surrender merely because of present inability to pay for the weapons which we know they must have. I do not recommend that we make them a loan of dollars with which to pay for these weapons, a loan to be repaid in dollars. I recommend that we make it possible for those nations to continue to obtain war materials in the United States, fitting their orders into our own program, and nearly all of their material would, if the time ever came, be useful in our own defense. For what we send abroad, we shall be repaid. Repaid within a reasonable time following the close of hostilities. Repaid in similar materials, or at our option in other goods of many kinds, which they can produce and which we need. Let us say to the democracy, we Americans are vitally concerned in your defense of freedom. We are putting forth our energy, our resources, and our organizing power to give you the strength to regain and maintain a free world. We shall send you, in ever-increasing numbers, ships, planes,
tanks, guns. That is our purpose and our pledge.
In these future days, which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want, which translated into world terms means economic understandings which will secure to every nation a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants everywhere in the world. The fourth is freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armament to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world.
A few days later, Congress debated the largest peacetime defense budget in our history, $10 billion. In February, Hitler thundered the threat that all ships bearing arms to England would be sunk. Churchill answered with a resounding pledge to America: "You give us the arms and we will finish the job." The Battle of the Atlantic was on in earnest. The war had entered a new phase. The democracies were fighting back.
The Axis threat was a threat not only to us, but to all the Americas. From the White House on May 27, 1941, in the presence of the representatives of Canada and the 21 American republics, the President spoke on hemisphere defense. The winter of 1940-41 had seen the first British offensives on land. General Wavell drove the Italians from the Egyptian border and destroyed Graziani's army on Libyan soil. The liberation of Ethiopia had begun. But Rommel's Africa Corps crossed into Libya to begin its sensational desert career. In the spring, the Nazis invaded the Balkans and Greece. A British expeditionary force from Africa met the Germans on classical soil at Mount Olympus and Thermopylae. The British were driven out, and the Nazis captured the island of Crete. With the approach of summer, the tempo of war increased.
June 2nd, Hitler and Mussolini meet at the Brenner Pass. June 8th, British and Free French invade Syria. June 11th, British begin air offensive on Western Germany. June 22nd, Nazis invade Soviet Russia. June 23rd, Germans take Brest-Litovsk. July 1st, American troops arrive in Iceland. July 5th, German armies reach Stalin line. July 12th, Great Britain signs military pact with Soviet Russia. July 21st, President Roosevelt calls for the continuation of selective service.
On September 4th, a German submarine attacked the United States destroyer Greer. Against this hostile act, the President protested in a White House broadcast on Labor Day.
My obligation as President is historic. It is clear. Yes, it is inescapable. It is no act of war on our part when we decide to protect the seas that are vital to American defense. The aggression is not ours. Ours is solely defense. But let this warning be clear. From now on, if German or Italian vessels of war enter the waters, the protection of which is necessary for American defense, they do so at their own peril. The orders which I have given as Commander-in-Chief of the United States Army and Navy are to carry out that policy at once. The sole responsibility rests upon Germany. There will be no shooting unless Germany continues to seek it. That is my obvious duty in this crisis. That is the clear right of this sovereign nation. This is the only step possible. If we would keep tight the wall of defense which we are pledged to maintain around this Western Hemisphere. I have no illusions about the gravity of this step. I have not taken it hurriedly or lightly. It is the result of months and months of constant thought and anxiety and prayer. In the protection of your nation and mine, it cannot be avoided. The American people have faced other grave crises in their history. With American courage, with American resolution, they will do no less today.
A Rendezvous with Destiny, on Tuned to Yesterday, an NBC production from March 27, 1946. And that wraps up this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.